Yo, what's going on, people?
Welcome to I'm Not Supposed to Be Here.
I was a little late.
That's fine. That's fine. That's fine.
We're tired.
I was a little late.
I didn't hear the drum hit.
No, it's all good. Welcome back, people. And if this is your first time here listening, then welcome. I am your host. Not so much with the most, but I got a lot.
Yeah.
Trent L. Dixon.
You got enough.
I'm here with my man.
Eclectic Sage.
Yes. And we're joined by two newbies.
Whoa.
Yep.
First timers.
Introduce myself.
Yeah.
My name is Raphael. I'm a current biology student at NYU.
Woo.
Do a little bit of everything.
Yeah. Childhood best friend.
Oh, yeah, we go way back.
We go way back.
Hydroponics, yeah. Robotics, everything.
Fire times.
I'm proud of that guy.
Yeah. What's your name?
My name's Omari. I am a freelance photographer. I also do lo-fi hip-hop on the side.
Hey. Yeah. New project out. I'm gonna listen to that shit.
You got a new project out?
Yeah.
What's the name? Drop it.
The Echo Chamber. Go listen to Shinji's Lust. You know, I love Evangelion so much. It's some of my favorite animes.
Where can we listen to that at?
Spotify.
Yeah,
so, and what's your artist name? What's your artist name?
Yeah, The Slow Rewind.
Yeah.
Also, my gamer tag, so if I teabag you, you know it's me.
Well, PSN is down as of the recording of this. And
I think it went back up.
Oh, it went back up. Now I did the podcast, but that everybody will know it as like the day PSN went down. That's all I saw for like hours. People were like, PSN, no! No, I guess I did.
That's what you were saying. I was on Twitter on the other side. I was looking at Kanye tweeting.
Oh no! I don't even want to mention it. That's for another day. But one thing, as an audience, I just don't respect that people were just constantly feeding and engaging in more content. It doesn't from whatever side. I'm not gonna go too in depth, but it's just like obviously he's having a manic episode. Obviously, like at this point in time in 2025, we can tell he's having an episode. This is not like new. It was just the severity of what was said was crazy, but it wasn't like new behavior. So like the fans going like just giving him more ammo to just keep on accelerating the rant. It was just like throwing gasoline on a wildfire. It was just like, come on, guys.
I didn't even hear what he said. I saw that he was speaking, and I just kind of passed over.
That was the proper response. That was the proper response.
It's not going to be one thing. He's going to go off for like 10 to 20 minutes, maybe even longer.
Yeah, that was a proper response.
Honestly. That's fun.
Yeah.
How's everybody doing this week? How's everybody's week been, though?
I'm doing great right now. I went to Fashion Week earlier today, like I said before. Shout out Runway 7. Great brand, great industry. Met some beautiful people, met some nice people. Can't give them the names off the top of my head, but you know, as photography, you're always networking, you're always meeting new people.
Yeah, absolutely.
I miss CapClit. CapClit, I miss you. Please come back.
Is it really gone? I haven't checked my phone to see if
I think you can download it. So the thing is with like the TikTok ban and everything is that with that, you can't really, the app stores have vested interest in not reselling it because they still can get penalized for selling the app. So the app can't be sold on app stores because if they do sell it, then they're liable for whatever happens in the future for the law. And it's like in the weird kind of purgatory space. So if you have it downloaded, you got it still. But if they try to sell you a new copy, it's clipped. So there's some people on TikTok. There's What Remains. Yeah. And same with CapCut because the same parent company.
I still have my free CapCut app. I haven't tried to log into it, so I was like, oh, CapCut is gone.
If you didn't have it or like if there's an update or whatever, it's clipped. If you want the AI features, I don't think they work. I don't think they work really. But what did you usually use CapCut for?
You know, there's this pro cutout tool, and it's so easy. They use AI for it, but like it's just, I would just rub my finger over it, and you could do the same thing in Lightroom.
Yeah.
But CapCut, it was so quicker.
It was just the edge point.
Almost an elitism to it, because sometimes they'll just make clips for you.
Oh, that's fire! Like,
you know, it was so easy building your brand on Instagram or TikTok. Yeah. You know, I did anime, and it's like, just throw Nakami, Freddie Gibbs over it.
Yeah, then just if you have like a situation where it's just like very easy to kind of just cut clips, like especially when you're doing content creation. Because I remember when I was going straight like three reels a week, like every, like hitting the two platforms and having scheduled content, and that is just not fun to maintain, like just regularly. Mm-hmm. So it's just, it's nice when you have like a little tool that can just like cut up a clip a little bit faster, so that you're not staring at the editing screen for that long trying to post at like that frequency.
Yeah, no, it's definitely a lot. It's a lot of a rush, but no, enough about my photography trend.
Yeah, it's been going pretty well. Yeah,
yeah.
I've been in the lab most of the days trying to finish up my thesis. But
as far, what is your thesis? If you, can, if you give it, give us a little preview.
Yeah, tell us a little about you. Let's learn.
Frogs, yeah. Basically.
Frogs. Yeah, no. Frogs. Frogs is the thesis. That's the name of that business. Frogs is the thesis.
Frogs.
Frogs is the thesis.
Yeah. The project is a little multifaceted because what I study mainly right now is actually disease. So I like to do, I like to look into disease dynamics. And specifically this time I'm looking at how the space around the different habitats in the city where these frogs are is influencing the types of illnesses that they get. So like we're talking parasites in the blood, fungus that's transmitted by people on the skin. We're talking,
Oh yeah, if you're not ready for something grotesque, letting you guys know now, we're gonna get into the weeds of it. But I think that's like super important, and I will save the segue for a moment. But you did touch upon something. I was gonna segue, but I was just like, let's talk a little bit more. I mean, how you feeling, Trent?
Only 6 minutes in. I mean, we can segue. Oh,
we going straight in.
But I mean, if y'all want to.
But no, I'm feeling good. It's been a long and semi-stressful week, but it's still a good week. I've been working overtime, trying to add on to these projects so they can be done at some point.
Yes.
It's been good. I'm excited to not, well, I'm not, I'm going to edit photos tomorrow, but not do, I'm excited to turn my phone off tomorrow.
That's what I'm excited usually take like Sundays off to just like be off your phone.
Yeah,
and I respect that because I'm like, yeah, for me I need to get out the loop being on my phone so much.
I mean, it's helpful even if you do it for a couple of hours, like normally before I go to sleep I'll turn it off, and then I wake up and I'm like, okay, I'm not turning it on for a while, and I'll just get stuff done.
That's funny,
and you know, if it's definitely, you can definitely feel the difference, even with a couple of hours, you know, feeling refreshed and, you know, those cognitive functions are going.
Yeah, you're like, brain cells are regrowing.
Yes.
Time to destroy them on Monday.
Start remembering phone numbers that you thought you forgot.
No, remembering phone numbers is crazy.
It's crazy.
My week was chill. I'm just super excited. Good Nature Souls has me excited every day. I'm just like active. I'm getting to the point where I'm getting annoying to myself. Like you ever just be like, yeah, if I was on the other side of this, I'll start being like, But for me, I'm just a big ball of energy. And I'm just really happy I don't have to be in school and waste all that energy and time, because it doesn't feel like a drain doing all those stuff. So I'm actually feeling more productive than I was in school, because like nobody's asking me to do it. I'm doing it for myself. So it just feels more exciting. It's like, oh, wow, this is like everything's a passion project now. And I'm just very passionate. But yeah, to kind of piggyback off of what you were saying, Raphael, you were talking about how the environment and everything kind of influences the diseases and, you know, the inhabitants of, you know, Frogland. Wherever that may be, you know, there's a lot of frog species in New York.
Well, it impacts everything. Like, the diseases they get can be transmitted to us, to other animals, everything.
Yeah, and in the midst of, like, current conditions, to get a little bit more topical, you know, you have bird flu kind of flying around in populations and everything.
Oh, yeah, that did pop up.
You have a lot of stuff that's just very, very evident as we kind of progress in this kind of climate change new scenario that we're living in, where humans and animals are just getting ever closer, and the way that our environments are just too easy not to ignore or anymore. So it's very much a thing where, you know, the habitat around your area really is going to affect how you go about your days. And so, yeah, that's why today's episode is going to be about environmental racism. Absolutely. And yes, and we're going to be talking about just the different ways that it manifests, climate change being like the umbrella issue, but you know, it's very hard to attack it, and we'll kind of talk about that. But what's your kind of like experience or your kind of like forte of like approaching it? Because you are in the biology field, you're part of the community that's very adamant about doing that. And some of the, I guess, criticism for the community itself is that people are not equipped to communicate to the general public for just the scope of how it is. So it sounds very alarmist as opposed to like meeting people where they are.
Can I hit the pause button real quick?
Okay. Yeah.
Before we dive into it, for some people, can we define what environmental racism is?
Yeah. So let's start off with that. What do you think?
I don't really know a definition off the top of my head, but if I could come up with one, I'll do that for you.
Yeah.
Environmental racism to me is when your environment is influenced by an outside or something bigger than you, only for your negative outcome, not for anything positive, just for your negative outcome.
Yeah, relatively. That's pretty like head on the nail for that part. I couldn't think of the thing for real. But no, it really plays into that, and it's not just, you know, it's sociological in some respects, mm-hmm. and many respects, and then sometimes it's environmental in terms of like biology, what's around. So, you know, food deserts is the sociological aspect, but then you have the environmental aspect of like, you know, how trees are not really properly apportioned. So certain avenues are super, super hot during the summer and it feels like you're about to melt. And it's like super polluted in the city regularly. And then, you know, there's no trees on your block to kind of absorb some of that. So it's a lot of dimensions to it.
And what's a food desert?
A food desert is basically, you could see it very, very clearly in New York City. In certain places it's very hard to tell. Mm-hmm. But like a food desert is pretty much an area of like the city, just by the way that the city had apportioned land to certain groups of people at given times, that leads to maybe your main food source being the corner deli, and that's it. And that being your main grocery store. Or, you know, you may have a Popeyes, a Taco Bell. We're losing sponsors. Taco Bell, and we're losing endorsements. And a Chili's right next to each other. And, you know, there's no actual grocery store for like 5 blocks further down, and so, you know, you go to whatever's convenient or to you. And absolutely. Then there's some places where those are not even there, so it really is just that corner deli. Mm. And it's very funny because you can see it, and this is kind of going a little bit ahead of myself, but in certain places of like the city where people go into gentrifying an area, you know, those food deserts don't just heal up by just adding a couple coffee shops during the day, because when you have to get food at night, it really is just mm-hmm. that one deli still. And so it not only affects people on the basis of like, oh yeah, this is just this population facing this population is facing it. It hits pretty universally. It's just that it's targeted as something that's just to make it unequal for specific people.
It's something in the business landscape that's not just about the customer, it's about the business as well, which is something that's very unique that we see inside of the term.
Yeah, yeah. Because even businesses like, I don't know, an example, I'm sorry, Trader Joe's, I love you guys somewhat, I mean, whenever they put a Trader Joe's in Harlem, it has like a graffiti Harlem on it, but when you go to Trader Joe's downtown, there's not real visibility, and it kind of ties into what you're saying before with like watching Black Panther movie. It's just like some of it is performative in nature, some of it is just actually trying to combat some of the systemic and institutional issues that we see, and some of it is not deep enough in its aspirations or its like format or whatever to kind of really attack the issue.
Yeah, to cut you off for a second. When I worked security, I'm not gonna bleep this out.
Yeah, yeah, yeah. We're ready.
I got you. Hold up. All right, whenever you're ready.
When I worked at as a security guard, you're good. I always would take the like express bus home because first time getting money, first job, you know, I'm going to splurge a bit. There was a chop right there next to the Popeyes. And for some reason, after I got off of work, the Popeyes was always open. And the McDonald's, you know, there's two McDonald's right there at... but there's two McDonald's. One of them's always open, and the Popeye's always open. But the Chopped is always closed.
Yeah,
which is very weird. You know, it always strikes me as like, why isn't there any food? Why do I have to DoorDash it so early? Because I used to DoorDash it at to work at sometimes.
Yeah.
But then, when I was ate it because, you know, I usually work the night shift. I didn't work the morning shift. When I worked the morning shift and I ate it, I was like, why don't they have these in the Bronx? And then,
yeah,
like, oh, yeah, we do have these. They're called Chipotle. And I was like, that's mm-hmm. for us. And I was like, wow.
Yeah.
So it's not, I don't think it's just about the brands and the people. I think there's a self-service for us to go, even us to go out there and just like, what are we missing out on, you know?
Yeah. Like, and it, you don't really know, like some people, like I remember being like younger in the city when you, because I grew up in the Bronx and it was a, or I was in Presbyterian Hospital, like around Washington Heights when I was like younger, like to like seven-ish or whatever. And then I grew up in the Bronx. And when you go to the Bronx, a lot of it, when you grow up, you're just like, oh yeah, going to the city was like a cool thing. So like whenever we got like a half day, the cool thing was just to go see Times Square and mm-hmm. just look at ads. Cause it was just like, you rarely went out to Manhattan on your own accord when you were younger, especially on the outer boroughs. And it wasn't until like you hit your teens that you could kind of explore the other boroughs kind of. And so you don't really see that when you're younger, or you don't really notice the things that you're lacking when you're younger. And then it takes you a little bit to like realize some of like the kind of disproportionate like service that you get. So like I remember when I was younger, I used to love like Quiznos when those were like around the city. Man. And like hey, shout out to Quiznos. But Quiznos was like a kind of Subway kind of like offshoot alternative whenever. And it was like they'll have those in the city, but they wouldn't have those in the Bronx, or they wouldn't have that in the Bronx, or similar to like the Chopped. But when you like really think about it, it's like the people that are mainly open during that time of like the Chopped and everything, mm-hmm. it's just like lunchtime, five, like midday hours. So it's mostly people working in the offices. And so servicing mostly white collared or higher level paying jobs mm-hmm. and just by proxy of that. And then when it hits like the night shift and it's like there's still people moving around because we're just still the city that never sleeps. It's just like, oh yeah, you're not really serving the same people or the certain type of like resources. So even that plays into the sociological kind of like impact of what businesses play a part into. And it's not really a main thing. It's like what makes me most money. It's not like intentionally I'm gonna just disenfranchise people, because realistically they would want to stay open for hours. But it's just like, how many am I, if I'm limited on the amount of hours I can apportion, let me get the maximum amount of people. And in that you create a system. Because now you're maximizing for the maximal type of thing, and you end up not serving everybody. And that's pretty much like the environmental racism definition for me. Like, you maximize for something else that's not people, and you maximize the deficit that people experience as a result. And it kind of plays off of a lot of different aspects of that and what that means for different peoples, whether it be Hispanic, immigrant populations, migrant populations, first generation, second generation, third generation, even people that live that are white collared, that blue collared workers. Doesn't matter class, doesn't matter race, doesn't matter religious beliefs. It affects all of us because we're all inhabitants of the city. Mm-hmm. And so it leads to a worse experience as a part of that. But I guess what's your biological lens take?
Well, I don't know if you could call this a biological lens take, but yeah. If I had to give it a definition, I would say that it's the either willful or unintentional, addressing of an environment, right? Or yeah. It's a willful or unintentional impacting of a community or an environment, you know, And it doesn't necessarily matter what the reason is, right? So it doesn't matter if it's for like a restaurant or for, you know, it's action by the city. All that matters is that one group is being disenfranchised or negatively impacted and the other group is benefiting from it, right?
Exactly.
There has to be the give and take there, because mm-hmm. if it's one-sided, then I think that falls more into the category of not so much environmental racism, but more of the wider scope of why like certain things are bad for everybody everywhere.
Yeah.
But environmental racism is a very specific thing, so we have to be specific about how we talk about it.
Yeah,
you feel me?
Yeah. So I'll lessen my scope a little bit, but I'll,
or you were on the spot with that.
No. But I'll lessen the scope, because the thing is that like when you go into like critical studies or critical theories about like a lot of these things, it can get like very in the weeds and very technical about Absolutely. Like what's included and what's not included. So I guess for like the scope, just focusing on a lot of the environmental impacts. How does it lead to that? Because kind of like the frogs, you know. If you're eating Popeyes every day, is it really a thing that black people have genetically different modifications to their body that predisposes them to specific diseases of diabetes? Or is it really that, you know, a lot of people, let's say your grandparents worked the night shift or they worked this thing, and then, you know, they got older, they had kids, and then that manifested in their DNA. Now you have a food desert and you only go to the bodega and you eat a honey bun because it's 50 cents. And that's the allowance money that you get. And then it goes through generations, and now the third person, now somebody's hit with diabetes or something. Mm-hmm. Now it's not a case of, like, this is something of a situation where, you know, they're predisposed to this, right? They say they use the notion of predisposed condition or pre-existing condition as a genealogical type of thing if you go up the family tree. But it's really just, you know, did you water your plants? Did you really take care of the soil around that plant for the tree not to have, like, those cancerous lumps on it? And it plays into, like, a lot of ways in which people have certain interpretations of, like, the medicine that people need, the way that people have to go around in the city. Like, if you live next to a power plant, especially for the case of environmental racism, a lot of people have asthma. And it's like, you know, a lot of people have asthma as a result of just being located close or around plants or around mm-hmm. a lot of high pollution areas.
Yeah, you can take the example of the Bronx. Statistically mm-hmm. speaking, at least for the Bronx, South Bronx, and for Harlem, the young individuals there tested for asthma and stuff like that, they test 10% higher than the areas around them, so the rest of the city. They're 10% yeah. higher rates of asthma and other things like eczema. We call it the big three, you know, like yeah. asthma, eczema, allergies.
Yeah.
All this shit.
And it's just like, is yeah. that really just a population of people, and is it really not just the things around them? And so it's just like evolving the scope of, like, you know, it's very easy to blame a person because you can see a person, but you can't see, you know, a system.
Soft targets.
Yeah.
And for the point you made about diabetes, there's the distinction between the two types. So there's one that is the genetic one, and then there's the other one that's dietary. So that one, or not dietary necessarily, because it factors very closely with environmental racism. Because if your options, like the idea of a food desert is not that it's completely lacking in food, it's that your options are, you know, poor in nutritional quality or poor in vitamin quality. So mm-hmm. It manifests.
You know? Yeah, manifests in, like, your ability to kind of move and operate in the world and everything.
Yeah.
You know, I feel obligated as the fat guy in the room to speak up on this, but, you know, last year I used to have a crazy Gusher addiction. I used to eat, like,
Gushers are so good, though.
You know? I used to eat 10, like, not the boxes itself, but the individual packs. I used to eat 10 a day. 5 a day, like, every day, you know what I mean? Just gouging, just every day, like, you know. And sometimes I would be in this, like, even when I would go to the store, I would stand there and I would, like, be, do I really want to eat this, or do I just want to a quick snack? Can I eat something? Yeah. You know, and then sometimes I would get the Nutri-Grain bars, or I would, but, you know, then I look, you know, it's just as simple as reading the back of the packaging, almost the same amount of sugar.
Yeah, so it's like, it's like a false sense of choice. Yeah, it's a false sense of choice. And realistically, like, if you just had, like, an orange, that was just like, if that's why when I go to, shout out to Jules, man. But, like, if you hang around Jules, he always has, like, an orange pack, and you always see his, like, asking for oranges. But it's just like, yeah, or like a watermelon or something, some type of fruit. But he always, like, tries to instill it in us, like, yo, you don't need to, like, have that much sugar. Because for me, I have a huge sweet tooth. I have, like, cookies, and I have, like, really bad sweet tooth. Like, I remember when I was, like, 7, I had, like, 4 cavities off of just, like, just eating mad sweets, and then I had to chill out after that. But, like, but, yeah, it's just, like, you know, when I do go to the grocery store or whatever, it's just, like, the fruits that I see there, they don't look really, like, appetite like that. I've had so many rotten, like, apples or oranges or, like, bananas that just, like, make me a little hesitant to just be, like, yeah, I'm gonna take my chance on this one store that may not really cycle their products that much mm-hmm. and just, like, give it a try. Like, you could bleep this one out, but I remember I was at school. Oh, wait. No, yeah. I was, my fault. Let me give the context. I was at school, and they had, like, the display food, and it was for, and there was mold on the glass. Oh, my gosh. I think I talked about it last episode, but it was mold on the food, on the glass, and it was just, like, I saw that, and then there used to be, like, an Instagram for just, like, just jokes for the campus.
Oh, Lord.
And it was just, like, that was one of the ones that made it to the campus once, because I took the picture. It was just, like, yeah, this is not. And that happens consistently. That happens with just, you know, not that drastic, but in general, it looks like stuff that's, like, unripe, improper, and whatever.
Mm-hmm.
And then there's the way they advertise it to us, right? Because if you've gone into a bodega or if you've gone into a supermarket, we see these packages on the shelves that are like the brightest or some of the rarest colors, you know, in a natural environment. Not to go into the naturalistic fallacy here, right? But like, you know, we walk into the store, we see these orange packets, these red packets, these yellow packets of like Gushers is a perfect example. They're That's the most brilliant. It looks like a fruit. The bag looks like a fruit, or the box looks like a fruit, or you know, we have all these massive labels on them. So it's like it's tricking our brain into thinking like, oh, you know, like. I need this, and in my mind, I need that. Like I do need that.
Yeah, you know? It even and then you're rewarded for it too. Yeah.
I was gonna say even pushing that idea a step further, you know, pushing it to kids to where you have these bright, colorful cartoon characters. Because I remember, oh my God, Saturday morning cartoon commercials used to be the best.
Yeah,
but you know, you have all these cartoon characters like Trix the Rabbit, Trix are for kids. They have all these slogans, and they sort of get that in your head, and then you know, you start saying that as a kid, and that feeds it, and then you start to develop that sugar addiction. It's like I need it, I gotta have it. You know, bless my mom too, because I used to drink a lot of sodas, and I was a blur around the house.
Oh,
I was
man!
Back and forth. What was your favorite? What's up?
What was your favorite?
My favorite soda?
Yeah.
Anything that was sweet, like I guess my favorite was Sprite.
Sprite is a good soda.
If y'all want to send us some money, we open Sprite.
I have a LeBron commercial. Terrible. Yeah. Oh man, they used to have like Drake like turn us out. Drake's face like just split into two.
What is it?
Oh man, I'm pretty sure that's how he feels right now. Hey, I don't need the Drake feature.
Fuck that guy.
Hey, the stimulus package has you know, government funding is up as we've seen. terrible. Yeah, this is gonna be the platform I lose a lot of sponsors. I can tell. Hey,
I mean, we've already lost Ja Rule. We've already lost Snoop Dogg.
Yo, you hit Ja Rule with the belt.
Yeah.
That's for the season one lore. You gotta go back.
Go back and check that out. Oh man.
That's funny as hell.
Pushing it forward, I just want to give a little context. So while writing this episode, I was trying to figure out, you know, where does this come from? Where does it start? There's a lot. I didn't want to go back to racism. I didn't want to go back to slavery. So I had my cutoff point, and I'm just gonna bore y'all down with my what I wrote here. We're talking about what's up.
I said I'm interested. You still have all night ears, icy. I was like, you still working?
I deleted and restarted, and it's still not. Like I was, even when talking to you, we were talking about like what to focus on, and it's still like
it's a huge issue.
It is, and it's so many things I had to, intentionally leave out, even though I want to talk about it.
Yeah,
but anyway, so. I decided to go back to the New Deal. And what that was, it's a series of programs and projects created and enacted under the Franklin D. Roosevelt presidency in the 1930s. And some of that was actually the beginnings of some of that was actually in the late 1920s as well. But the purpose was to create economic relief for Americans. Oh, yeah. And hence... Here on out, I'm gonna start calling America Turtle Island because Turtle I like it better. Shouts out to the natives. But anyway, the purpose was to create economic relief, and part of that New Deal was the National Housing Act of 1934, which aimed to build homes, improve housing conditions and standards, and that was done by increasing access to affordable mortgages, which would eventually boost the economy by creating jobs through construction and banking, et cetera, et cetera. Where was I? Once again, it'll help people improve their chances of receiving affordable home loans. And so through that also, you know, you have to decide who gets a loan, who's more likely to pay it off and who's not. Mm-hmm. So that's where the Homeowners Loan Corporation came in.
Yep.
And they created what is called a residential security map, which kind of ranked different areas based on their investment risk. Yeah. And so you have the different tiers. You have the green tier, which is...
I'm sorry to cut you off. I think I heard of this redlining.
Yes,
that's where I'm getting.
This is where it
spoilers.
Spoilers. Hey.
Yes, but we're getting to that.
Man's is excited.
But no, exactly.
He was like, redlining.
I know this one. you have your green tier, which is an automatic yes. You have your blue tier, which is, you know, it's still good. They're still going to get it. The yellow, which is, you know, the parts of society which are declining. And, of course, the red, mm-hmm. which, of course, if you haven't guessed it, make up black people. They might throw immigrants in there and Hispanic maybe even some poor white people. You know. But anyway, yeah, so... And that's where you get the term redlining. Now, so what happened with that is you get... You lose out on, people of color start to lose out on economic opportunities to refinance or to buy new homes.
Yep.
And then you have all these new suburbs being created. And then so white people are moving there and the businesses. And
it's white flight.
Yeah. White flight.
White flight.
Which I don't think it's the official white flight. It might have been like the pre-white
flight. There's always a white flight.
Yeah, there's several white flights, and it's
always white flight.
They got wings all the time.
Which is I'm gonna speak to that a little later too.
Unreadable all the time.
But
they can sponsor us. I'll do a couple flips.
So where was I?
You guys just saw what I said now.
Hey, it gives me wings.
No. So then you get, like I said, people of color start to lose access to different financial opportunities. All the white people leave.
Yeah.
All the companies leave. And then all the best resources start to go into those new suburbs. And then what you have is you have this vulnerable population where the industrial businesses start to push their factories and all these other things to that side, which is kind of a double-edged sword because you start to create, you know, jobs for that financial need that you have.
Yeah.
But you also start to make people susceptible to different conditions like lead, water poisoning, air pollution, all these different things. There are even some cases where the soil contained lead, where, you know, you can't even touch the ground, which is crazy because, no, you're a kid. What? Everybody, if I ask you what it felt like to roll in grass, you could tell me, right? You get itchy, but it's fun as hell because, you know, you're a kid, you know, so you get all these conditions that sort of lead to, what's the term, I wanted to call it perpetual. I can't think of it now. I wrote it down somewhere. I have like four different sets of notes.
Yeah.
But anyway, so that's how we get to a place where, you know, disenfranchised people or marginalized people sort of always end up in these situations where, you know, they're shorter lifespans and. Excuse me, I'm not used to talking this much. Shorter lifespans, shorter lifespans, and more health risks and things of that nature. But yeah, I just wanted to sort of throw that in to give a little context before we really start.
Yeah, I think that's really much needed context. And I was talking to you, Rafael, and everything. I was just like, yeah, like especially growing up in the city, like the scars of it are very, very, very present. And I try to stress this to people that like are not from the city and everything. But I mean, hey, a lot of things develop as like defense mechanisms. Like I think I spoke about it on one episode, but I was talking about how once you reach like certain numbers in the city, let's say you're taking the 2 line, you know, you reach 96, you know, predominantly white people are all off by the train by that time. So
facts.
So
I was thinking about
that. Yeah, the train the other it's day. Very obvious and very quick and it's very silent, and but it's very much a part of that kind of history of, you know, the valuable land holdings of things were downtown. And even people that lived in places like Seneca Village that only recently in Central Park that they just started talking about was like a thriving black community that ended up getting like, you know, kind of leveled as a part of making Central Park and whatever that entailed. And, you know, people just kept on getting moved out and pushed out to the outer boroughs. And especially now we can kind of see it even in the way that trains are run, Because the trains, when we do our MTA episode, it's like they were all separated lines and everything, and they were not all unified until like the 60s. So before that, it was really just, how do I get this population to just not exist in this area? And, you know, it made it so that Manhattan, and by proxy, a lot of these places like, you know, Queens and Brooklyn and the Bronx and Staten Island, like all these boroughs ended up in like weird kind of developmental situations. And new technologies were always here first, because New York is a very, it's probably like one of the best harbors, if not the best harbor in like the world, just naturally, for a lot of things, because it just allows for easy trade. It has fresh water and salt water, so like the water is very brackish. It's very easy to navigate up all the way to the Hudson, to go all the way up, and then you can push it to the Great Lakes if you really wanted to. It's very easy to navigate, as opposed to like trying to like go up the Mississippi or something like that, geographically speaking. I know geography, not everybody's like a fan, but environment and geography play a big part into how you formulate as a person. And to kind of round this tangent out, it's a lot of that, those decisions that were made maybe, let's say, 50 or 100 years ago, you know, are important. The decisions that they made when we're little kids,
yeah,
is going to profoundly affect your kids. And, you know, you may tell them that, but when you look at the eyes of the kid, he has no frame of context. And so that's what we're dealing with when we deal with like a lot of these issues, because none of us were really around during that time, FDR, but we still feel the effects of that. The effects of, let's say, like a president like Woodrow Wilson, who would, you know, be predominantly responsible for segregating the government, that led to some of the inequality to even transfer into FDR administration. And that's even for FDR, that's like when he was a kid. And so you have decisions being made when you're kids, when you're not really able to, and it plays into, you know, your later life. Similar to, if I was a kid, I was rolling around in the grass, you know, in the glass too, but I was like in the broken glass, yeah, but depending on where you were, it was glass, but you know, yeah, it extends, you know, you have lead poisoning and stuff that plays into a part of like how you grew up. Now your kids don't play in the grass, now your kids are
or think inside. Of the boomers with the lighted gasoline in the planes, like that,
yeah,
that did things to that generation,
yeah. I mean, they
cigarettes in the airplane,
or the gasoline that would come out of the pipes in the engine.
They almost killed our ozone layer. Thank goodness, mm-hmm, that we were able to kind of reverse that with like the metals and stuff. There's more context to a lot of these things, but you know, certain decisions were made in which like it damaged the environment like really bad, and we weren't really paying attention and knowing the full scope of like industrialization. What does it mean to do these things? Mm-hmm. Not really asking the questions that are really important. Like if we spray our hair, it's gonna like mess up the ozone, and you're just like, how? And it's like, you know, through science and through, you know, testing over a long period of time, it takes a long time to really see the correlation between things. And you know, when people speak about it, it's already to a point where, you know, you make your money, you're pretty settled in what you do, so it's very hard to change footing. Mm-hmm. And there's not really an incentive to do that.
Not an incentive to do the right thing, and that's the problem now with a lot of society. You don't do the right thing because you want to feel good after, you want a reward. You do it because it's not even because it's the right thing to do. You do good to make the world better. It's bigger than you, and you know, not to sound like a oh my lord, I sound like a communist right now. sorry, all my Republicans out there. Yeah, you guys aren't gonna like this one. To be honest, I don't think there's a single person who could care about climate change, illegal immigration, and say themselves that, oh no, I'm definitely right. I'm definitely like right extreme. I don't know.
Yeah.
You guys can't hear it, but there's a little stuff going on outside right now.
Yeah, it's kind of part of your fashion show. I don't know. After the episode, we're gonna go join them. But
yeah, hey, if you see me strutting down the runway, I'm fashionable. I'm on point. I'm dressed to the nines.
You can't be on the right side of the political spectrum and care about people that's outside of your community. I feel like when you're right-minded, you are privileged yourself, as in you're almost closing off, it's not my problem.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. And
that sucks, you know.
Yeah, and I think to kind of go into that little tangent, I think in the United States, there's two different...
Turtle Island.
Yeah. Oh, wait, my fault. Yes, Turtle Island and Turtle Island. I keep
pushing that. Turtle Island, yes, 2025.
Yes, Turtle Island, all 2025. But yeah, on Turtle Island, you know, and there's two types of politics for the general public. There's ideological type of politics where it's just like every issue is just left or right. Yes. And then there's like actual politics, like what policies are actually going in. And when you look at like the actual thing that's going in, most Americans are pretty aligned. It's just when you reach the surface level of just the appearance of, is this left, is this my team, is this not my team, that's when you kind of run into an issue. Mm-hmm. So everybody would be like, we love this issue, we think this should be okay. But a lot of people vote in their disinterest because they may not agree on another issue. Mm-hmm. And it's all under the umbrella of like left or right.
Or even even more so maybe because they're uneducated about it and
yep,
they
too.
Have certain people telling them that, hey, this thing is the reason why you don't have a job. This thing is the reason you can't afford to buy medicine or blah, blah, blah and all mm-hmm. that, you know. So a lot of times people get bamboozled into voting for housing. I don't know. That's the best word I could come up with. But, you know, it's lot of miseducation.
A lot of willful ignorance, too. It's just like once you feel like something is wrong, but people like to make a decision on, you know, wrong information. And then if it blows up in their face, you know, it's a bit of like, oh man, like woe is me. But if it doesn't, hey, they did the right thing for them. And it's like, it's from a privileged position of like, oh yeah, like the consequences to me particularly, not very much.
And also, sorry to cut you off, some people just don't like feeling dumb or wrong, you know.
Yeah, that's true.
It's you know, especially as adults shaping the future, I feel like we have to get over that, you know. It's one thing to say, okay, I made the wrong decision, please inform me of how I go about the right way to help the society as a bigger place. Versus just, oh well, she'll figure it out.
Yeah.
You know what I mean? He'll figure it out. No,
yeah, everybody's afraid of, we live in a culture of nihilism and existentialism and postmodernism. Those are a lot of big technical words, but that's the thing. But we also live in a culture of like domination. And domination is very, to like break it down, it's like people are scared of someone, you know, having the power to make their life less in a lot of ways. So, you know, when you admit defeat in terms of like intellectual or like being smart, it's like, you know, you have to admit that you made something wrong. Now you have to question everything, because now if I'm getting my whole entire sense of meaning from like my smarts, and you just broke a hole through my wall of smarts, you know, I can't let you invade my castle. I have to like either burn my city down myself or go down with my ship, and for metaphor's purpose, and not let you really like dominate me in that sense. Because I will have the last word, and that's a lot of what we deal with in a lot of different ways and when we talk about issues like this too.
Is there any suicidal parasites that you could kind of that you could bring up that kind of relate to the subtext?
Like a suicidal parasite? Yes. So the first thing that comes to mind, it's a worm. Worms suck. Worms are awful. It's called the Gordian worm. And the way you can find it, if you want to see one, if you ever come across a grasshopper or a mantis, and you grab that mantis, you drop it in a bucket of water or a puddle, that sensation of being in the water will trigger the worm to activate. So it'll start bursting out of the body of the mantis.
Oh, I've seen that.
I think I've seen that here, dude.
That's crazy.
Dude, it's like hair. Oh,
wow.
Yeah, they look like a cooked spaghetti.
Wow. I do not like worms at all. It's crazy that, like, is it true? I heard this somewhere. Is it true that for most history, like, people had worms for, like, majority?
You have worms right now. I'm sorry. You gotta make a peace with the worms.
Yeah. I'm pretty sure I have some, but it was just, like, to the point, like, there were higher levels of them.
Oh, definitely. Most definitely. There's been a lot of changes with, like, standards of health improving. I mean, New York City is a good example because we have good water if you ignore the massive lead problem.
Hey.
And the fact that we're still dumping, like in times of heavy rain, we still open our sewer systems into the Hudson. And if you've been there around that time when that's happening, fish kills, they call them fish kills. So you'll be walking around the piers and you'll see just thousands of fish floating in the water because we pooped in there. Like,
Is it Trash Island here as well?
There's so much stuff in New York City. Like, New York City has such a rich history, and it's so cool. Like, there used to really be whales. Like,
there still are. They saw one recently.
And what happened was because, you know, similar to like beavers and shit, they you know, they used to use blubber from the whales as oil. And they used to just send expeditions to just kill all the whales in the water. So, I mean, obviously the whales are just like, I'm not going to die here.
I mean, I'm not really missing the beavers. No disrespect.
Really? Why not? Damn.
I'm not a beaver guy, man. I'm so with you.
You don't like Buc-ee's?
I love our planet. It actually motivated me to become a photographer. I've always been Antarctica guy myself.
Yeah.
Like Arctic fox. Polar bears. Shout out to them guys. Shout out to all polar bears. Gonna be gone from climate change in like 10, 20 years. Like, imagine your kid not knowing what a polar bear is.
Looking at it in a book like it's a damn dinosaur.
I felt a little bit of that one though, when the polar bear that was, you know, he shouldn't have been in the Bronx Zoo, but he was there when he passed away recently.
Did he look depressed all the time?
He did. But I don't know what is the story with why there was a polar bear there, but I mean, they try to make the enclosure as nice as possible. But yeah, he would just look like he was just hot over all the time. So I just felt like bad.
It's cold up there, man.
And we must remember that the Bronx Zoo once housed African people in their exhibits.
Oh, wow.
Yo, run that back.
Yeah, they used to exhibit us.
Wow, that's crazy. I live right next to the Bronx Zoo.
I want to burn something right now.
Wow. Yeah, things are different now.
It's Black History Month. Wow.
Get in detail, man.
Get in detail. Yeah.
I mean, like, we could.
Hey, we got tangents.
Let's get in.
We got time.
Wait, hold on. Just to do a quick sidetrack while he looks that up, I was looking up a quick fun fact.
What's
up? We love fun facts.
In the 1950s and 1960s, at a part of a policy called deinstitutionalization, this policy replaced long-term care in hospitals with community-based services. Now, that may sound familiar to you. Fidelis Care, Medicaid.
Yeah.
They shut down a lot of asylums.
Oh, yes. Yes.
So bringing back to our topic here, you know, I see on a train going downtown today, you know, I was up at probably 9:30, 10 o'clock taking the train.
Yeah.
One side of the car, everybody's minding their business. On the other side, it's three people just on the floor covered in drug. Like,
wow.
Like, piss, you know? It's just horrible, you know, just watching that. And it's just like, these people need help.
Have you heard the term social Darwinism?
Ooh, yes, that lives in the city, for real.
It's infamous. It's related to a problem with American individualism, too. But it speaks to this idea that, like, or proponents of the theory argue that, you know, it's the concept of survival of the fittest, right? So the people who are able to survive in the harsh environment are going to adapt or through evolution and become more suitable to it. The issue, which, as we've seen, like a good case study is New York City, right? Because there's a lot of significant figures who've played into this. This is all part of the big branch of eugenics.
Eugenics is a big one. We'll talk about eugenics for a second, because that is really a New York-centered thing.
And it's related to social Darwinism. So there's this idea, and it goes back to what we were talking about earlier, about how there's this, not suicidal, it's this self-attacking nature that minority groups or disenfranchised groups within the system can experience, where it's like you're acting against your best interest, right?
Absolutely.
But the term they use now, I guess, is like bootstrap politics, right? It trains you from the moment you're here to think of it as like, oh, I have to do this for myself. I have to succeed, and my worth is dependent on what I can produce and all this shit, and I have to do it myself, blah, blah, blah. But that's not how the system works. It's like, how do we activate, you know, our community, you know, and get them to a point where they can be cognizant of it, right? Like, we're advocating against ourselves. We need to do something about that. We need to fix that.
And I've been like sitting on this for a long time, because it's like, it's really hard, because after a point, it's not really about awareness or education or whatever, but after a certain point, it's like, you know, you have the knowledge, you have the thing, and you can still, we're at a point now where, you know, you can willfully act ignorant with little to no consequences in terms of like politics, in terms
that's
of
privilege.
Like, and it's like a privilege that people are using or trying to develop and trying to like get better at, to grift and try to become the fittest in a lot of ways. And so it's like, I think now is like important to create platforms and do things in a specific manner that allow for you to speak on issues that are not necessarily like pretty, but it's just like our survival is staked on that. And I kind of go into like Darwinism and everything. Like, yeah, it was, you know, even when you learn about who Charles Darwin was, he was just, you know, a person that was on a voyage as like a person that was just supposed to document finches. And then they went to a couple other islands and he already had predisposition to looking at native and indigenous people that were of different cultures that were not European descent as less than.
Also, real quick to clarify for the record, he was studying barnacle dicks.
Oh,
for
he was
14 years.
Yeah, that's
and then he went well in the Galapagos on the beach.
Yeah, and then
oh, pardon me, sir.
Yeah.
Well, I only say that because I don't really fuck with Darwin. I appreciate his contribution to science. Like evolution as a concept was essential for our, you know.
Yeah.
It's 2025. Yeah. 2025. Come on, yeah. Evolution's real. Yeah. But like, his cousin was the father of eugenic science, like Francis Galton. Yeah. If you don't know him.
And this also speaks to, I didn't think we were gonna get into it today, but it's really fire. That science, in a lot of ways, the origins of it can forward a lot of our beliefs into what the future holds for us.
But we also must remember that the origins of it are from a white supremacist superstructure.
Yeah.
Like Ivory Tower is real.
Yeah.
What is that?
That's this idea that science, since it is a, it's pretty limited to like affluent members of the population, or it's biased towards wealthy people. So it tends to accumulate its resources and its power in this structure that is referred to as the ivory tower. So,
yeah,
like basically, the people don't have access to the knowledge.
Okay.
Yeah.
No, you know, I was trying to read Pierre Bourdieu's distinction earlier today.
Yeah.
Yo, I don't understand half the words he's saying. You know, it's a French book.
Yeah.
And you know, I was supposed to go to Paris this summer, but I canceled it because it was just like, I was going for the wrong reasons, you know. I always thought of the French as a very artsy, very intelligent. Probably a little self-esteem issues myself, but maybe I was looking towards the past. But these, like, when he's talking in a book, you know, he's talking about these social issues, and I'm like, I don't understand what you're talking about. What do you mean the ivory tower? What do you mean?
Yeah,
like, you know, these terms and all this, I can't quote anything specifically, but back to the book, he's just saying words and I'm just like, what are you saying? Mind you, this is the English translation. It's originally a French book, so
I've had that issue as well. Yeah. You know, earlier, trying to read a French translated,
I've my first ever book that I read probably in my teen years, you know, that's crazy that I say that, was probably James Baldwin,
Giovanni's
Room.
Dude, legend. Yeah.
My high school teacher, shout out, bleep this, Mila.
Yo, shout out to them.
Shout out to my guy. He gave me a book. That's the book, James Baldwin, Giovanni's Room. It was very, very fond to me, about a man cheating on his wife. Can we talk about that a bit? Hold on, let's cut off the book. What do you got on that, Raphael? What do you got about relationships inside of the Black family, the Black home, the domestic violence, and the scandalous nature of that, man? Tell us about that.
Yeah, that's a, I mean, I can speak to my experience in my community. I can't speak for everybody's experience, but yeah, I think the problem, as many problems, it boils down to the men, right, in this society.
Yeah.
So, and this is not to say that it's like we have to attack men or anything like that. No. It's like, and it goes back to what we were talking about earlier about the American individualism, right? We've divested from our responsibility to the youth or to our peers, because, you know, normally the culture is responsible for when someone does some shit, right, to their family or some shit that's reprehensible, and you all know about it. You're not supposed to awkwardly sit around and be silent. You're supposed to teach that guy not to fucking do that ever again. Yeah. We don't do that here.
Yeah.
We don't do
and
that.
And it makes
so it's
it,
an accountability issue.
Yeah.
Yeah. And it's a mix of like understanding that.
That's part
like,
of it. That's not all of it.
Yeah. There's a lot of it. Course. I think a big kind of main thing that is like a gateway to understanding it is that the power that you get from these things hurts you as well. And to kind of tie it back to what we said before previously with food deserts, when somebody gentrifies an area that used to be a food desert, it's not like the issue disappears. It's not like you know, you move in and then the buildings change because you moved in. Somebody has to put in the work to dismantle a lot of the work that somebody else had to put to really oppress somebody else. And there's this book by Isabel Wilkerson, and she talks about the nature of caste in society. There's some things I disagree with, but she gives a good framework for understanding the intersection between classism and racism, yes, and how it plays on a society level, which I appreciate because it just gives you language that's easy for people to understand. And anyone that gives language for people to understand, whether it be through music or through art, is giving people the ability to communicate to something. I think that's the function of art, to give people the language to be able to move, because even language itself is an art,
or even to anchor them, right? Because think about how many, at least growing up like in the Bronx, like I was pretty angsty and shit, but having representation, having some type of support system, whether it's a song or a show to tell you you're not alone, the culture can save you, you know, like you have to know that there's a support system, there's a history that brought you to being here, and the answer is not, you know, crashing out on everyone you love or on random people in the street.
Oh, yeah. I hope that term does not stick around long term.
Well, it's a trend. It's gonna go away.
It's gonna go away, but
it's a really old term.
Yeah, but I love the term crashing out. It's a very visceral, like, When you really think about what you're saying, it's a very visceral, like, type of thing. Because, like, if you, like, the instances of crashing out is, like, what? Like, a stagecoach, like, falling over in a waterfall and, like, washing away. Or, like, a car, like, flipping a mill. Like, you don't just hit, like, a barrier or something. Like, you're crashing out. Like, your is active. And, you know, it takes a lot of energy to do that. And so, it's just, like, I think it just highlights the terms kind of, like, for me, personally. I find it funny because it's just, like, you know, you're putting a lot of energy in the wrong things, essentially, and you're just like, you burned out. But where are you getting that energy from? And talks to, like, society in general.
I feel your sentiment, though. I think it's an overused term, because, you know, the littlest inconvenience and you show it. Oh, you're crashing out.
Yeah.
I think it's definitely overused.
It's especially useful, though, I think, for talking. And, you know, maybe this is a little bit blunt or on the nose, but it's especially useful for talking about, like, white school shootings, right? Like, when they're radicalized by like this ideal of white supremacy, or creating the master race or whatever, and they go out and they're literally like, oh, I'm gonna go kill a bunch of people. Or there was you guys probably know the details, there was that shooting of the black church, right? And the mosques, we can mention the mosques.
Rest in peace to the individual that went through that. I don't like that the main political thing is, like, my condolences and then not do an issue. It is, like, egregious that that's the case, especially in the United States, where it's very manageable. And there's a lot of money in the industry that prevents it from being like that. Mm-hmm. From lobbyists to, you know, individual gun owners that don't want to surrender in this kind of area or culture of domination, where who gives you the authority to, you know, speak on what I can do? And then if I have to surrender that, what else do I have to surrender to you? And so that kind of culture of those several things is not just, you know, like we said, it's hard to shoot a system. And it's hard to, you know,
soft targets.
Yeah. And, you know, a lot of what we see in crime or criminology is, you know, I think one of the most important contributions to criminology, I forgot who said it, but it's like the environment breeds the criminal. The criminals are not spontaneous. Oh, and it's just like, when you really look at, you know, apply that logic to the things around you, that the environment around you plays a significant factor into how you are, it allows you to see the world for what it is. Because there was never a time where we really, you know, escaped our kind of state as a being, as an entity of humanity. And
you mean like as an organism, like as a
species? Yeah, like as an organism, and really detached from the environment. We just created more safety precautions and things, but we're not whole. Yeah, preventions, but we're to make it feel safer. But the scariest thing to admit is that you're still ingrained in the natural order of
system. You know what's crazy to say this?
Yeah,
you guys are gonna live. I am a certified crazy person, so I'm going to be very, you know.
You have papers? You're certified? Like,
okay, so I'm going to do a quick self-biography for you guys. My name is Amari. When I was very young, I used to go around telling people, I want to be a sniper when I get older.
Yeah.
A sniper. Like, that's how much my life is ingrained in violence. Mind you, I was never a fighter. Mm-hmm. Never went to school, never fought people, outside of school. Didn't really grow up in the hood.
Yeah.
You know, I live in, well, leave this for a second.
But, I'm crying. I live in the same area. I love the area.
Dude, I think, is it not getting gentrified?
No, it is. It is.
That's what I'm saying. Yeah.
But that area has always been very much not encompassing of black people in particular.
Also, shout out to my Italian brothers and shout out.
Yo,
to
the elbows down the block. The elbows down the block. Hey, hit them up. Hit them up.
Yeah, they are heat, but
they're the far. Block.
Yeah, they are far from us.
Anybody that's Eastern European, I love you guys. You guys are so cool, so cool, and such rich history, such cool people. I think all European people are really cool. I just don't like, you know, the nature of colonization and what it speaks to over history. Doesn't mean that your culture is bad. It just means there are bad things that were done. Mm-hmm. And that goes for any culture. There are bad things. There's people in places like India that have two sects of religion, but they use their power to oppress and use the same type of domination.
You could give them a name. Those are the Hindu nationalists from Modi's party. There's been killings in the streets, and it's been awful for anyone who's Muslim in the areas.
Oh, wow. Facts. Yeah. Yeah.
Damn, like in the street, like they're grabbing the
riots where they'll kill a bunch of Muslim people.
Just a bunch of them.
Yeah. Yep.
That's crazy.
And it's done by nationalists.
Do you know what he is?
Yes and no.
It's the BJP. If you look them up, if anyone wants to Google it. Yeah.
Yeah. There's a lot of things like politically. There's that. There's the Uyghurs and the camps in China. There's a lot of domination in society. Just somebody trying to have authority for their own kind of precautions for creating a safer environment for themselves, and then excluding another group in order to, you know, gain resources, gain peace in their type of semblance. But you really can't separate yourself from nature. You can't separate. Like if a flood happens, it hits everyone.
Yes.
As much as we create, you know, states and boundaries, the fact is we all live on the same planet together.
Mm-hmm.
You know, and all these issues affect us. Is somebody knocking on the
door? Yo. Yeah. No, they're just thinking. Anyway, a model member of society always knocks before you enter.
Yeah, they got something to say about environmental racists that could come in. Yeah. But to reel it in a little bit, so I guess how do we, you know, we've talked about a lot of the issues and we've talked about some of the causes. How do we go about creating accountability for people that are responsible, and also accountability for ourselves?
Yes.
Well, back to my crazy person rant. Like, hey. I don't want to do a self crazy biography. Well, I'm gonna skip to the best part. I went to a Four Winds Mental Hospital. I was inserted there because my first bout of violence, I punched my brother in the face. I broke his nose.
Oh, wow. Yeah.
Yeah, he was just like waking me up all night. Like, I could not sleep, and I just like tweaked out. I crashed out. That's the time.
You crashed out. Yeah.
Very appropriate.
I stayed there for 2 weeks, and it was actually surprisingly well funded. Now, I never asked my mother how I got into that place.
Yeah.
Or if it's government funded. I never asked.
Yeah.
You know, 9 times out of 10 it isn't government funded.
Yeah, it's privately funded.
The hospital bill was crazy. But, you know, it's about getting people in these places who need that help. You know what I mean? At the time, I was a crazy kid. I was just, put me on different type of pills. You know, they didn't understand me. I was going to therapy at the time. I was called a schizophrenic. I was called ADHD, extremist. Like, you know, different things, you know. But if you ask me, I think I'm just a little different.
Yeah.
But that's an extremely tamed way of saying things. I think, obviously, when you have a society struggling with not just mental health, but just an understanding of oneself, you know, to really sit down and even have the time to critically assess yourself and your emotions, that there's going to be a lot of people at the time, just at randomly occurring times, crashing out. Like, shout out to Zach Fox for his favorite tweet. Yeah. And white people be killing their whole family and they put an image of them smiling.
Yeah.
You know?
Yeah, that's another societal, like, the image of it is an important thing too, because the image you kind of portray in regards to that is super important. And this kind of lends to your question about how do you deal with accountability. A lot of people get lost in the image of, you know, change, or the image of progress, or the image of who's to blame. And, you know, we were talking about it before with, you know, the image of who's responsible for, let's say, a superstructure. Superstructure, for definition, is like you know, a big type of issue that affects everyone and is really hard to combat by just saying, like, let's fight climate change. That's climate change is a superstructure. It's really big. It has everything.
A lot of moving parts.
A lot of moving parts. And, you know, like, getting the fishermen more higher wages is fighting climate change. But it doesn't sound like it's related, but it is. Mm-hmm. So it's just upgrading his quality of life. It enforces stricter standards. And so that allows for not so much overfishing, and then that attacks climate change. But there's levels. It starts from small things.
So much building blocks.
Yes.
The foundation.
Yes, and that plays into the image of things. So to kind of tie into what I was talking with you like before, Raphael, like the image of who is responsible, who bears the responsibility, can also be leveraged against populations that are affecting the brunt of these things.
And that's tied very closely to the concept that the state has to have a monopoly on violence, right? Because when the face of the state is the same face that's perpetrating violence against everybody, they don't get hit with the same hammer as, you know, someone of a different identity, right? They don't get hit with the same penalties. And it's almost like there's a permissibility or a pride in certain cases, right? Like when someone, you know, crashes out and a bunch of people die, like there's all these people who start to, you know, mimic them or remember them, you know, like there's a whole subculture of it. And
it's horrifying. And that plays into, like, for the case of environmental racism and everything, it's like it plays into, like, let's say oil companies and how an oil company might approach the image of, you know, we're doing our oil, but, you know, if you recycle and you have uphold the image of doing recycling programs, that will fix it. Mm-hmm. And then, you know, misattributing that to the superstructure of things. So, you know, the same way you say, like, you pay the fisher more wages, you know, you fix the thing. Imagine if you told the fisher, like, you know, if you just work harder, and, you know, you just do, you give more fish for us, you know, that will fix climate change. Or you give them
a misdirection.
And there's a lot of things that happen. So, like, you know, the biggest polluters of people in history have been the people that, you know, make the plastic plants, are responsible for trash management, are responsible for energy production, are responsible for enforcing standards. And then they turn around and, very similar to like Charles Darwin or whatever, you apply it to the individual. And so with the individual being at the mercy of whatever the state or whatever entity, it makes it very easy to just tell that person, hey, you're just not recycling enough, or you're not doing this to kind of hit those thresholds.
I'm sorry to cut you off. As a marketing major, it's all in the media. It's how we perceive these things and these people themselves. Mm-hmm. You know, often I see there's a disconnect to the reality.
Yeah.
Like one of the craziest shows, Deadliest Catch.
Yeah.
You know how much damage that does to the environment.
Yeah, that system that there's those crabs that they're fishing are in collapse. Their population is collapsing. It's overfished to hell.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
No, it's horrible. Can you inform us more about that, Raphael?
Well, I was thinking about it earlier when you brought up fisheries, because that's one of the most interesting facets of this entire spiel to talk about, right? Because global fishery systems, like this is, that refers to anywhere where there's a specific population of fish being, you know, taken for selling at the market.
Yeah,
there's,
similar to like the whales, like
you're saying. Yeah, like the whale. They still do whaling in certain parts of Europe, certain parts of Japan. But it's horrifying. So in the United States, for example, 50% of our fisheries are subsidized. So that means that they're, if you look into the numbers, we're seeing less and less profits each year as they catch less and less. And if you've ever looked at a map, there's bays like Cape, or there's places like Cape Cod, right?
Yeah.
Or Pompano Beach in Florida.
Yeah.
You don't catch the fish that they're named after at these places anymore because they've all been removed. And you have examples like trawling. That's a method of removing fish from the ocean. Like they'll use it in shrimp fisheries, right? So they'll basically drag a giant net along the bottom of the ocean and it destroys everything. It rips up the coral, rips up the plants.
Everything
is destroyed.
That's horrible.
And at the end, when they go to see, you know, reap the rewards of this whole deal, 10% of all the animals they catch are what they're actually looking for. Everything else is bycatch.
So collateral damage.
Yeah. 90% collateral.
Damn. Yeah. Fish spoils quicker than chicken and beef. So
chicken's the bomb.
You know what I mean?
Yeah.
Chicken's the bomb.
Yeah.
But this is obvious. You know, you can't, and this is the problem with talking about supermarkets, back to our soft targets.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
You know, a lot of these supermarkets, these local supermarkets, they can't afford to sell fish because fish spoils so fast.
Yeah.
Versus you could freeze a steak. You could freeze some chicken 10 days. You know what I mean? There's resolution. Sometimes it's even pre-cooked. Now, that isn't healthy, but you could sell that.
Yeah.
It's all about making. Mm. Sometimes it is all about making profit.
And you got to know where it's coming from. So I have a question for you guys. Have you ever had Chilean sea bass by any chance?
No. I have. No. No. I don't think so.
They sell it in supermarkets. It's like a, it's popped up, not like, it, within our lifetimes, it's popped up as something that's more popular.
Okay.
It's marketed as a sea bass. So like you can catch sea bass in the water around Manhattan. I've caught them. They're like black. They're pretty small, but they taste fantastic. But what they're selling in the store is not a sea bass at all. It's actually something from called an Antarctic toothfish. Which looks nothing like a sea bass, and you, they're only found in the waters around Antarctica. And the reason that we've turned to this species as a means of feeding ourselves is because all of our other fisheries are, you know, in collapse. So this is one of the last places we want.
I was gonna say one of the most least visited places on Earth.
On Earth,
and we're, like the last we're pillaging it. We're pillaging.
Yeah,
ridiculous.
Yeah. And then you know another aspect that we are seeing now politically is like you know it's a bit of both. It's both. Both sides of the spectrum are kind of playing, right?
Yeah.
People are saying, like, look at the Marvel movie, right? That we saw with just Thanos and everything, right? The overpopulation of planets, of overpopulation of species is a talking point that you see a lot of villains have in the nature of narrative.
Yes.
And that's because, you know, the ways in which we're adopting a lot of these things, if you want to look at it from the very limited perspective of what we were talking about before, like the ivory tower, or just the nature of, you know, this metric of science has only certain, a limited scope of results that is within its eyes, right?
Yeah.
Historically. It's very easy from that kind of sense to say, hey, we're overpopulated. But realistically, you're not. You're just being very careless in the ways and the choices that you're trying to catch food.
Yeah, you could literally fit every single human being in the Grand Canyon, and it would be a pretty, it would be a sight to see because that's fucking crazy. But like, for the, that's the amount of space we take up. It's how it's distributed. It's how the land is used.
Yeah, like imagine most of the United States is empty, but New Yorkers are all in one spot.
Or nice Texas topic. With those
wait,
McMansions.
Wait, wait, gentlemen. Mm-hmm. Let's talk about the empty homes, people sitting on empty houses.
Millionaire's Row?
Yeah, Millionaire's Row is a bad one. That's another one. But that also plays into environmental racism. Let's take it back to what I mentioned earlier in passing, like the Seneca Village. Mm-hmm. You know, the nature of Central Park as having a mainland park in the main city. When you look at it ecologically, how does like Central Park look?
Yeah, that's called, it's something that's called a neo-Europe, right? So to define that term, that's just, it's part of this movement of how the people who own the means of, you know, change, like, so the people who are working in the parks and shaping them, in specific, it was one guy, I forget his name, I can get it for you later.
Yeah.
He did Central Park and Prospect Park. The entire thing is manicured, and it's done specifically to mimic the landscape of Europe. So on Lenape ground, we're mimicking the landscape of the colonizers. Every rock you see, every cave, every tree, every hole was placed there specifically.
Wow.
And at the, in the end of the day, it's one of the fantastic biodiversity for birds, right? Great place for birds. But
for
if you know what an ecosystem is supposed to look like, if you know what a healthy forest looks like, Central Park is a system in crisis. And it's because of how it was built. And then if we take, the last patch of remnant forest in the city, which is located on in the Inwood, in that neighborhood in Manhattan.
Shout out Inwood.
Yeah, oldest forest in the city. It's fantastic. That is like a totally different story because it's also a system in crisis, not because it was never cut, but because it's now being invaded by things from the outside.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
Yeah. So imagine systems in crisis. Systems in crisis is a constant type of thing that we're seeing. And it's just like, you know, you go into Central Park and it's all by design. Because we decided to make these design decisions, this is the output that we did.
Yeah, like lawns, fuck lawns.
Yeah. We kill the biodiversity and the environments. We kill this type of thing. But, and then we also make it so that it's an attraction on top of that.
Mm-hmm.
So we create this environment, we make it an attraction, we increase the foot traffic to it, and then we make it very popular. Now people are like, hey, my property value, because there's a popular attraction, attraction so close, so convenient,
mm-hmm.
raises value. Now it's to the point where it's more valuable if I just hold on to it and wait for one person to buy it prospectively sometime, somewhen, as opposed to somebody just enjoying it. And it makes it so that we create ghost towns artificially. Artificially, because that there's million, if you really appropriated the amount of space that they just created just off of Billionaire's Row is what they call it. You can fit most, if not all, of the homeless population of New York City.
The homeless crisis is by design.
Yeah. And so things are by design. It's by design. And that's why I felt like this topic was like super important to bring up environmental racism. And, you know, the environment plays into just the small decisions that we make on a day to day, especially as we assume roles of having power and understanding the nature of what it means to be dominated, what it means to be domineering, and what it means to operate in a society where it's very easy to not be able to tell the lines until it's way later, or maybe make a decision on information that you don't even know the origin of it.
Trent, as an older individual, how has...
We gotta get a wall for that.
Hey, y'all, this podcast is over. We're right. Thank you for listening. No, I'm sorry.
As an older visual, an older individual. As a slightly older individual.
As a handsome young man.
Go for it.
How has Central Park changed throughout your life, and how has the environment of the homeowners changed?
That's a great question. So when I was in Texas, I could not see Central Park.
Well, how was the homeowners like in Texas growing up?
Say that one more time.
How was the homeowners like in Texas growing up?
It's interesting. You know, if I can, I guess if I can get on my little soapbox for a second, if we're talking about housing and environmental racism. I'm going to make it quick because we're going to wrap this episode up soon.
Yeah.
So Austin itself is divided. There was something that came out in 1928 called the Master Plan.
Whoa.
Essentially what that was is that was a plan to sort of divide minorities and separate them from essentially white neighborhoods. So
yeah,
through a bunch of different factors, let's say refusing service, disabling utilities, the list goes on. You know, they were able to push black people to the east side, which, you know, that population is made up by Latino as well. And then they were able to push Mexicans to the south side. And so that's kind of where we were designated. That's where a big part of the population was. Now, as time went on, as I got older, you know, people started to realize, hey, there are no, you know, Texas, it doesn't have that extra tax on it. It's kind of cheap to live in Texas. So now we started to get a lot of people, especially from California.
Yeah.
People coming in and moving there. And so what happens is a lot of places on the east side, you had a low property value. And so people would come in, snatch that up, build up, and raise that property value. Now you have people who've been there all their life. They can't afford to live there. And so a good portion, the black population in Austin is actually declining. When I left, it declined by like 30% because we don't have a lot of black people.
Austin's blue, right?
Yeah.
Austin, yes.
But also, yeah.
But so I guess to answer your question a little bit, it's getting, and I don't even know if that answered your question. It's kind of triggered me a little bit. but yeah, and I think there's a significance in that. And if I were to speak on how, I guess environmental racism has personally affected me, I start to see things that as I was a kid and things that I was emotionally connected to, things that were important to me that felt like it was a part of history, start to disappear and get replaced by, you know, all these condos, all these luxury apartments, Starbucks, yeah. You know, all these other things. And it's crazy. Like I remember there was this club called 1808. Now, every week somebody would pull a gun out, but yeah. nobody to my knowledge, nobody got shot, at least not while I was there. My friend frequented, but that was where a friend of mine who does music kind of got his start. Like they would let a lot of local artists perform, mm-hmm. You know, and that gave people a chance to, you know, from an artistic standpoint, be heard, you know, and it was all black, it was all us. And now that doesn't exist anymore. I don't know what the fuck's there, but I don't know. It's anyway. What's the question?
No. But you bring up like a key thing that I did want to touch on before we end the episode. And it's the measures that are used like as an enforcement of environmental racism. And, you know, we were talking about it like with Robert Moses. Mm. And, you know, I wanted to make sure that we talked about it, especially growing up in the city. One like slight note. Yeah. Like as a part of like that population kind of like dissipating and fleeing. I mean, look, you're in New York City now.
Yeah.
Like you're a part of that.
It's a diaspora.
That type of movement and the kind of movement of like the diaspora people. And, you know, when we talk about like the city history, we talk about like Robert Moses as being like one of like, if not the top person as to why the city is shaped the way it is with like the amount of highways and everything and the way that populations are split.
So every single day on my way from the train station in Parkchester to my place, I walk across the Cross Bronx Expressway, and I think about that man. He takes up too much space in my brain.
Who is Robert Moses?
So he was in my brain. The little folder he's in is called the Architect of Death, yes. Or Architect of Decay, because yes. That man did horrible things. Cross Bronx Expressway.
He's got a little black folder.
Yeah. A little mark on the name.
There might be steam coming out.
Yeah,
of it.
Yeah, because he fractionated the neighborhoods of oftentimes predominantly black people in the South Bronx, oftentimes Latino too.
Yeah,
He said fuck everybody.
Especially if you look in the areas of like the South Bronx and like Hunts Point and Soundview and all those areas in Parkchester, like the way that the highway is, it splits it very irregularly, and it doesn't like when you look at the map, it's just like why is this so fractured like this?
And before it was there, it was a sealed gap. It was one unified neighborhood. There weren't all these, you know, strip malls and all these little like we were talking about earlier about this the fast food chains popping up. It was a solid community that was destroyed.
So go into that a little bit. When you say fractionized, what do you mean by that?
Yeah,
like, what did he actually do to the neighborhood?
As part of the process of city planning, you have to draw out, you know, where you're going to put the new arteries or the new veins of transport. You know, how are people going to drive X, Y, and Z place? And the philosophy that they employed was that, okay, we don't care about, you know, obviously we don't care. We don't give a fuck about black people. So obviously, we're going to build this right through the neighborhood like they do with a lot of the towns, like they do with the Mountain Valley Pipeline. You know, there's a billion examples. And in doing that, you know, they disenfranchise thousands.
Yeah, like I'm just showing Trent on the side, but like look how the highways are pretty much cutting here, here, for your reference, here, here, and here. All that used to just be connected together. It used to just be like a local road. Yeah. And it's just like, do you really need a highway system to kind of cut through all this type of mesh of community? And, you know, highways historically, especially with like the acts on the federal level and then by proxy, like the local level, led to, you know, a lot of issues that, you know, that pervaded environmental racism, that led to families being separated, that led to a lot of damage on an ecological basis from populations of deer and populations of just animals moving about and their migratory patterns. It just played a huge role, and a lot of that design was not taken into account, and we still feel the effects of that. And, you know, like, they may throw a highway, and then just because Hunts Point is, like, now designated as a manufacturing zone as a part of the highway, now you have all that kind of pervasive type of pollution that's as a result of manufacturing.
One of the worst spots for air quality in the city.
Yeah, because it's, like, right next to the Bronx River, right off the Long Island Sound, and now you have one of the most polluted portions and everything that you see in the city. And that's just, like, local. And then, you know, even with designations of, like, you know, Rikers Island being like right off the island, right off that point. It's just like you have Rikers using now with this fractured population, now the population of that with the lack of opportunity and a lot of ways with just white flight and a lot of societal things led to that being one, if not the most populated jails ever. Wow. And it's just like, things of that nature affect your environment. If you grow up in that type of environment, it leads to more likely cases of, you know, dealing with a disease, dealing with sickness, dealing with that. And that can also lead to people being very nihilistic, very sad, very depressed, deal with higher risk of mental illness because of what surrounds them as well.
And this is a perfect point to talk about Pelham. Like, the story of Pelham ties all of this together, I think.
Yeah.
So if anyone hasn't seen it, Pelham Bay is a park located in the northeast of the Bronx.
Yeah.
And if you've heard of Orchard Beach, Pelham North is where Orchard Beach is. So there's two main sections. There's one on the landmass below it, and there's one on landmass above it. And so the way they were built, again, is tied to Robert Moses. So Pelham Bay South, this is the one accessible from the 6th train. So you get off, you walk across that bridge across, I don't know if it's across Bronx, it's one of the expressways. Yeah. You walk across it and you get to that park. That's the one that most people have access to, especially people of lower income or people who don't own a car, which we're in the city. Like, I don't, who has a car? So you get there. And if you know the history of that park, like, I've done research on both. Pelham South is a landfill. So it wasn't there naturally. The stuff there that was originally there is...
That makes sense, because Orchard Beach is on that side.
Yeah, well, Orchard Beach is actually on Pelham North. So that's on a separate landmass entirely. So it's... The forest there is healthy. The forest there is old, is pretty decently mature. There's salamanders in the leaf litter and shit.
Yeah.
It gets weird when you think about how it was built, right? So they're disconnected. So people who can access Pelham Bay South cannot, without a car, access Pelham Bay North. So the only way to get there is by public transportation, which is inefficient, and it stops running after a certain time. Mm-hmm. So when they were building Pelham Bay North, they were thinking, okay, we can exclude certain people of certain identities if we structure it like this. Like, public transport won't get there. The roads are going to be, super, super hard to traverse. Not super hard to traverse, but you know what I mean.
Yeah, I know what you mean.
So it's essentially, or it was segregated for many, many years. Mm-hmm. You know, only white people, or predominantly white people, had access to the north, to the actual safe area. And Pelham Bay South today has sewage drainage. Like, you can go, I've dug for eels in the area for there.
Yeah.
You can walk right up to the landfill. People dig for shellfish, for food and shit. And it's just left there. It's a beautiful place, though. Don't get me wrong.
The irony is, I was supposed to do a photo shoot in what's that? Right off the small island, City Island.
Yes,
I did. Oh, that place is cursed.
You know how there's no train up there.
Nope.
The bus, like you said, mm-hmm. certain time. You know the gate, like the actual, it gets cut off at a certain time.
That's who it's for.
You know what I mean? Yeah. So I was supposed to do a photo shoot up there recently, and I was like, there's no way I'm getting up here. There's no way I'm going to be able to get up there and go to school. And I trying to cut time in my schedule, I'm like, you know, as a black kid in the Bronx, I'm not rich. Like, I'm definitely not. I don't have time to cut costs or do things. So I was like, basically, this is an opportunity called loss for me. Like how we was talking about the jobs earlier. Like, this is...
Yeah, it's like the cutoff. It's like the City Island is the chopped of Pelham Bay.
Well, it's a very old population of very white people.
Yeah, and I actually like I used to go to City Island as a kid. I loved the little hibachi Ohana thing.
Oh yeah, I know the exact spot.
Yo, shout out to that restaurant that's so far. But
and the Crab Shack.
Yo, and the Crab Shack, they have really good seafood. I remember, like, as a little kid, they brought me over and I used to, like, feed the seagulls, like, my french fries. Like, not recommended, but, like, it was very cute.
Oh, they take it.
They'll just take it. Yeah, seagulls are not picky. But, yeah, like, just accessibility to spaces like that. And I think to kind of close the conversation a bit, because we're running out of time, it's just, what are the meaningful ways in which we can counteract this that, you know, are not really attacking the superstructure, but just attacking the local, making it so that we're able to see the impact of what we're doing so that it makes sense for us. And it's just like, you know what? Going to City Island, figuring out a way. Hey, we're all going to have a city meetup and we're all going to all go to City Island and we're all going to go to this restaurant during this time and we're all going to just mob big and just be happy that we're able to be visible in a space that wasn't intention for us. Mm-hmm. Be visible in sports that are not intention for you. Be visible in areas that are not intention for you. Be visible in conversations that you have with people, with the locals there. And just being present in the local environment, being knowledgeable of where the history of Pelham Bay Park is, to be history. Like, you could be around these places, but what does this dirt actually mean to you? Is there lead or glass in it? I don't even know. What is the history of that? And I think just bringing to light that type of awareness in the local makes it so that, you know what, I can fight the dirtiness of the Bronx River because it's right next to me. It's near my house. But I can't fight, like, fisheries overseas. But climate change is very much a thing where you got to attack the hyper local and go from there and expand forward.
Well, and to keep it blunt, we also don't want to fall victim to the idea that the master's tools can dismantle the master's house, right? So if we think about this larger structure of climate change and pollution, you know, like, sure, let's go actually with the example of the Bronx River, right?
Yeah.
Like, it's right next to us. But if you look at the sources of the pollution, they're far upstream. So we still have to broaden our horizons in order to do it. But my main point is, like, we have to deliver ourselves, you know, like, it's going to come from... the people, you know, to protect the people, because as we've seen, the state left to its own devices, or the government will not act in our best interest, right? And I just want to push a little further than just saying, like, knowing, because knowing doesn't change
the circumstances. No. Knowing is the first step, and the action has to follow. Action has to follow that knowing, and then on top of that, just having the capacity to organize and work with other people too. And also, you don't really need a lot to organize and just inspire people.
No, the most effective movements are decentralized.
Yeah. And then also a thing that I want to kind of express too is that, you know, it takes, when you're active and a participant in something, things are a little bit less, you know, spectacle based. You know, when you are in a world where, you know, if you look at the TV or you look at the screen and you're just looking at images, it's very easy to get overwhelmed and then passive. But if you're actively going out and doing this thing, then, like, something happening on the news, I mean, you can see the ground. It's not like, you know, a cloud is not going to hurt you from the ground unless lightning strikes. There has to be a connection. Yes. And it's just like, you know, most times, most lightning strikes are very rare. So you're just operating in a space where you're just on the ground. But a lot of people get lost in the clouds for a lot of issues.
And it's our job to pull them back down. Thank you guys for having me. Yeah. I appreciate it. Raphael.
Shout out to Mari. Closing out the episode. No.
I know.
Before we go, shout outs and thank yous.
Yeah. Sage. Well, shout out to you, Raphael. We didn't get to talk to everything that, like, you do, but I think we're going to do, like, a little Lucy episode, so I'm excited to hear that.
Oh, hell yeah.
Yeah. But, I'm just really happy. That we got to speak on this. This is not, like, the last time I want to bring up this issue many times over.
Part two.
Yeah, and just spread knowledge. I'm very thankful to the people around me that surround me with, like, art and science and discipline and make me a multidisciplinary person so that we can have episodes like this where we have people that work in music, but also people that work in science and do science, like real life science, and are able to, like, holistically share knowledge, share passion into what they do, and then also communicate, like, effectively with people. So that's my thank yous.
Mari, shout outs, thank yous.
I appreciate you guys having me on the show. Hopefully I could come back soon. As a marketing major myself, you know, I hate it feels like I'm rubbing it in people's faces sometimes.
Nah, we love working
as a marketing major.
As a hey, they gotta market the major.
I felt like it was appropriate for me to talk on this episode, as I have knowledge on the consumer's, like, not the consumer's mind, but also the business mind of things. You know, sometimes the disconnect, like I was bringing up earlier, the disconnect is louder than you think.
Yeah.
You know, like you were saying about the clouds, you know, you don't know what it's like until you go out there. You don't know what the rain feels like until you take off the jacket.
Yeah.
So I just want to say thank you for letting me on here, teaching me a few things. You know, thank you for pulling up.
Yo, you're welcome. We're going fast paced this episode, so I appreciate you being on and shit.
No, man, I'm happy to be surrounded by smart people like you guys. Appreciate it.
Yeah.
Raphael?
Yeah, it's a blessing to be here, to be around, you know, like you said, like, very smart people, and just, I don't know, I think it's really something special what we have here, because we said some things today that would have gotten us killed, like,
No, definitely. I try to use this platform as a place to, like, be self-hosted, be something that we can speak on topics, have a full range, and actually get to issues, because we're dealing in the land of politics, not ideological left, right.
And we must not be silent.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, and no, and definitely not. And we can go into depth on a lot of things, and you can just really attack the structures. And I take from the class of, like, structuralism and critical theory from that end, and try to employ that in the things that, like, I do around me. So, and yeah, I also want to just make it easy for just anybody to pick up. I think the biggest failing from people who are smart or call themselves smart is the ability to communicate to all levels. It should you should make it so that a kid can understand you. Yes. Because there are kids out there that don't have that language, that don't know what an ivory tower is, that, you know, they can reach that point, but it starts from somewhere.
It's our responsibility to teach them that.
Yeah. Facts. So facts.
Thank all of you.
Yeah.
All three of you guys for showing up, for pulling up. Raphael showed up 15 minutes early.
Yeah, so my fault.
He got to see me set up. No. It's all good. We talked a little bit, and I got a chance to go over some things. If you're listening to this and you're Black, thank you, because it is Black History Month, and you're beautiful. You know, you decided to get up and be yourself in the face of the world, and that's Black. Amazing. And thank you for listening. You know, even if you're not Black, you've been a very environmentally conscious audience.
I just wanna fly away. Look. Think I need a venue change. Need to be around some people who gon' keep my feelings safe. Keep my spirit locked and loaded. Niggas gonna see the safe and try to take my soul. But who they do, they know I got the cape. Flying high to see the sky, say bye bye to enemies. Funny when I've been up here, my demons look like many me's. I'm gon' keep it real to make sure these niggas feelin'.